This is the Tan Report. I'm your host, Han Trung. I'm going to start this episode of the podcast with some recordings of the initial dispatch calls from the Maryland Transportation Authority. It's from March 26th of this year, the day the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore collapsed after a massive cargo ship crashed into one of the bridge's support beams.
Any one of you guys on the south side, one of you guys on the north side, hold all traffic on the Key Bridge. There's a ship approaching that just lost their steering. So until you get that under control, we got to stop all traffic.
I'm holding traffic now. I was dragging, but we stopped prior to the bridge. So I'll have all out of the traffic stopped.
10-4, is there a crew working on the bridge right now?
Yeah, if we can stop traffic, just make sure no one's on the bridge right now. I'm not sure where. If there's a crew up there, you might want to notify whoever the foreman is, see if we can get them off the bridge temporarily.
10-4, once the other unit gets here, I'll ride up on the bridge. I have traffic stopped at this time. Once you get here, I'll go grab the workers on the Key Bridge and then stop the outer loop.
213 dispatch, the whole bridge just fell down. Start is whoever, everybody. The whole bridge just collapsed.
Do we know if all traffic was stopped?
I can't get to the other side, so the bridge is down.
It was around 1:30 in the morning. A mayday call from the Dolly, that's the name of the cargo ship, alerted first responders that the ship had lost power. The Dolly could not stop. Traffic to the bridge was cut off, but there was a crew of 8 men working on the Key Bridge. They were filling potholes when the bridge collapsed. 2 of them were rescued from the Patapsco River. The bodies of 2 others were recovered. The remaining 4 men are presumed to be dead. The recordings are from Broadcastify, which is this generation's version of the police scanner. Most of us have probably seen the video of that elision. And yes, I said elision, not collision. We'll get into what an elision is later. But first, let me get to why I'm even talking about a bridge collapse in Baltimore when this podcast revolves around all things New Orleans and Louisiana. The simple answer is I saw similarities. Both New Orleans and Baltimore are cities with major ports. The economies of both cities are closely connected to a river, the Mississippi for New Orleans, the Patapsco for Baltimore. And both cities want to increase the amount of cargo traffic to their ports. As someone who's been in journalism for some time now, I've never put much stock into the "could it happen here" story, mainly because I feel it can cause undue alarm. But sometimes the "could it happen here" story can be relevant, especially in a city like New Orleans, which has a major bridge in the form of the Crescent City Connection, above a major river. And there's a lot of traffic moving on the bridge, and a lot of traffic moving below it, on the Mississippi.
I'll give you some context on the average daily traffic of vehicles. We have over 165,000 vehicles that utilize the Crescent City Connection. That's both directions, that's in a 24-hour period. That is not only one of the biggest bridges as far as traffic in the district in the New Orleans area, but also in the whole state. You know, when you start ranking the Crescent City Connection, and you know what, another bridge that's in that category, the I-10 high-rise bridge over the Industrial Canal. That bridge also carries about 165,000 vehicles. Those two plus the Mississippi River Bridge in Baton Rouge, I mean, those are in your top 4 or 5 in the whole state. You know, when it comes to priority, you know, based on that traffic, those are going to be structures that we're paying very close attention to, from just the sheer amount of people that are going over them, as well as what you alluded to about the amount of our riverboat traffic that's going underneath them as well.
If you want to know about bridges or highways in Southeast Louisiana, this is your guy.
My name is Scott Boyle. I'm the DOTD District 02 Engineer Administrator, and I'm responsible for all maintenance, operation, and engineering activities in the greater New Orleans area. My area consists of 7 parishes, which includes Orleans, Jefferson, St. Bernard, Plaquemine, St. Charles, and Terrebonne and Lafourche in the Houma area. You know, within our district, we were responsible for over 1,200 bridges that we maintain and inspect on a 2-year basis minimum. Some bridges that we know that have known deficiencies, we're inspecting those on a more frequent cycle, sometimes even every 6 months. We take safety very seriously, and especially when it comes to bridges following federal regulations of which require to inspect these structures.
After what happened in Baltimore, I'm going to focus on the bridges near New Orleans and the shipping traffic in and out of the port of New Orleans. This episode is going to be less about accidents or bridge collapses, and more about why the size of cargo ships have dramatically grown since the 1950s, and why ports like the Port of New Orleans are investing billions of dollars to bring in more of these so-called monsters of the sea. Let's start with the bridges portion of the story. In the aftermath of the Key Bridge collapse, we might think of bridges with long spans, over water, or a highway, but their size can vary a lot, because down here, there are a lot of them.
You know, we certainly do have a lot of bridges, and it is a direct correlation to the amount of water we do have. The 1,200 bridges that are sited in our area, we're required to inspect those bridges. Now, I do need to clarify, out of those 1,200, 700 of those are what we call on-system bridges. These are bridges that we're totally responsible for. They're on the state highway system, the interstate system, the U.S. highway system. So we have an intimate responsibility with those 700 bridges. But we also have to inspect 500 other bridges that we call off system. These are bridges that are not on the state highway system. Like, I'll give you an example. One of our off system bridges are the arch bridges, the cobblestone bridges in City Park. You know, you wouldn't think that that would be something that DOTD would be involved with, but we do inspect those. Even though that those bridges are maintained by the City of New Orleans, City Park, as the federal partner, we're responsible for the program, and we have to ensure those bridges meet compliance as far as allowing motorists to drive over them.
So understanding your responsibility for those 1,200 bridges, in your professional role, what was going on in your mind as you were watching what many of us were seeing too, was the video of that cargo ship hitting the Key Bridge in Baltimore? Like, professionally, like, what goes through your head when you see that?
My initial thoughts were, when I noted the size of that ship coming in at what was calculated at approximately 10 miles per hour, it just seemed something that was just unavoidable, and something that there was no control and there was no engineering that could have tragically changed that outcome.
Scott was the one who introduced the word elision to me. It's a word folks in the maritime or nautical worlds use when something moving hits something that isn't. Here's how it came up in my conversation with Scott. You're trying to prevent crumbling and collapse and then collision. And I might be boiling it down too simplistically, but are those kind of the three kind of main areas that you have to be concerned with when you're a person in your position and the staff that you have?
Those are very accurate descriptions. We're looking at physical damage here. You know, there's all types of different damage that can occur. There's blunt force damage. There's damage due to settling. There's damage due to failing materials. There's damage due to weathering. So the words you described are what we consider just physical blunt force damage from and we call these an elision. You know, most people that I use that word to, they say, oh, you mean a collision. No, when there's a marine collision, that's referred to technically as an elision. So yeah, we're trying to do our best to minimize and reduce probabilities. Nothing is guaranteed when it comes to infrastructure, but certainly we can imply these engineering principles and do our very best to minimize probabilities of events from occurring.
To your knowledge, has anything similar to this happened in Louisiana history?
We deal with structural damage, I wouldn't say fairly regularly, but it does happen, especially when the river's high and moving fast. You know, of course, it doesn't translate into the whole bridge falling down, but when that water's moving fast and you're talking about a tugboat captain pushing a few barges, you know, anything can happen. They're certainly trained professionals, but, you know, again, you're talking about situations beyond their control. So we do have situations with minor damage, and we go out there when we're made aware of it and inspect those structures immediately. We work with the Coast Guard and file a report with the tugboat captain or with the boat captain. We do our best to inspect it. And if we have any type of issues, we wouldn't hesitate to close that structure down. To answer your question, I'm not aware of an imminent failure that's occurred. I've been with the department for over 28 years. And, you know, I haven't seen anything like that. I've certainly seen damage that we've been able to address and document and inspect, but nothing to what happened earlier this week in Baltimore. But certainly there are instances of elisions that occur. Just a rough estimate, you know, it does happen. And it typically, you know, if I had to put a number on it, it would be a handful of times a year, but they do happen. And again, we take those very seriously. Safety is of the highest priority at the department, especially when it comes to our roads and bridges.
Because this region is truly defined by the water surrounding it, one part of making sure bridges are safe is to have some protection from potential elisions.
Some of our larger bridges that are located on fast-moving type water, like the Mississippi River per se, and even some that are not on the Mississippi but on fast-moving channels, we do try our best to employ defense systems for these piers, whether it be a pier protection system, whether it be bumpers, whether it be a fender system that could direct an errant vessel away from the pier. So those are on display, not on every structure that we have, but certainly on some of the larger ones. And as an example, on the UEP Long Bridge, which goes over the Mississippi River, we have a protection system, a bumper system. So if a tugboat or something hits the pier, it's hard plastic, and it'll keep the concrete from cracking and redirect, possibly depending on the angle, a vessel. And on the Mississippi River Bridge, the Crescent City Connection, we do have a small fender system that can have the ability to redirect a vessel that would be heading for the pier. Certainly not an ocean liner that's loaded down with cargo, but a tugboat or a barge, it has the ability to redirect a vessel away from those critical structures. The same way that a guardrail on the highway will redirect a motorist from the bridge piers and avoid a tragic crash potentially there.
Scott has to be concerned about the traffic both moving below and on the bridges. That's because he's also responsible for issues related to roads and highways around here. For example, in the event of a hurricane and the interstate has to be shut down in one direction to better move people during evacuations, Scott is going to get a call. And because of that, I asked him what the protocol would be if traffic to the Crescent City Connection had to be cut off, like traffic to the Key Bridge had to be stopped after that Mayday call from the Dolly.
I guess it'd be most likely either state police or local authorities within the vicinity of, say, the Crescent City Connection that would be responding to shut that down, because we don't necessarily have any arms and we don't have any other automated ways to shut that bridge down remotely. You'd have to physically go there as law enforcement to shut it down. Is that correct?
That's correct. That bridge does not have that. Typically, when you see arms, those arms would be present on our movable bridges. These are bridges that when a vessel passes through the channel, the bridge goes up or the bridge swings open. And we got a number of bridges like that. We don't do those remotely either. We have a bridge operator that operates that bridge that has the functionality on site to do that. So no, there's no arms or anything like that. And I can tell you, you know, it would be no small feat to instantaneously shut down the Crescent City Connection Bridge or the UEP Long Bridge. I mean, it takes people to do that. It takes resources. And certainly in those type of situations, you know, I think it goes without saying everybody would do their best. But, you know, these are not instantaneous flipping a light switch to do something like that, especially when you're talking about the amount of traffic that we know is on those types of bridges.
Are you concerned about the size of cargo and barges that are moving underneath bridges like the Crescent City Connection?
You know, these vessels have been going up and down the river for many, many years. And you know, we have very competent captains as well as riverboat pilots that are at the helm of these vessels. Again, a tragedy and an unavoidable catastrophe is it could happen at any time, and we do our best to plan based on our engineering principles and guidelines and procedures in place. So we're all doing the best we can to keep traffic moving in a safe and efficient manner.
In some ways, it was unfair of me to ask Scott if the size of the cargo ships or barges raised safety concerns for him. The reality is, elisions on that scale are rare. And as you'll hear in a few moments, that kind of elision is even less likely at a bridge like the Crescent City Connection. Another reality is, cargo ships have gotten much bigger since the mid-1950s, when the first commercially successful cargo ship set sail from Newark, New Jersey, to Houston, Texas. That ship, the SS Ideal X, was 524 feet long and 30 feet wide. It had a cargo capacity of 800 TEUs, which stands for a 20-foot equivalent unit. Here's a way to think about it. One 20-foot container equals one TEU. Let's compare that to the Dolly. That cargo ship is almost 1,000 feet long, 160 feet wide, and has a capacity of 10,000 TEUs. That sounds massive. And when you watch the video of the bridge collapse, you can objectively say the Dolly is just that. But when you compare it to other modern cargo ships, it's about par for the course these days.
But it's the economy of scale, you know, that really drives that in the end. You know, when you can have a vessel with 9,683 containers or something along those lines, you know, which I think the largest vessel in the world right now on the container side is right at 23,000 TEUs. And so if you have 23,000 boxes, you know, that you think about just what you could fit into one shipping container, the economy of scale is off the chart.
Scott Boyle was our bridges guy. Matt Gresham will be our guy at the Port of New Orleans.
I'm Chief Government Affairs Officer for the Port of New Orleans and Public Belt Railroad and oversee state and federal government relations.
Very simplistically, is the size of cargo ships a reflection of the demand for goods?
Yes, and the demand for affordable goods. Because, you know, you think about what the shipping costs are built into, even the most day-to-day items that you're picking up at Target or a Walmart or a Lowe's, and how those items get here. It's always amazed me, even when you work in this industry for many years and you think, you know, how am I buying this $5 tool at Lowe's? There was probably some raw material that had to be shipped to the factory and wherever that may have been, then it had to have been manufactured, constructed, shipped, packaged, comes back all the way here from, you know, Northern Europe or Southeast Asia, and then is sold at a Lowe's for $4.67. And it, you know, just so you think about that and all the places that that one item has been. And it's the future of shipping. 90% of the world's goods move by water. I mean, that's just how it is. Everything from the clothes that you're wearing, the hat that you have on your head, your sunglasses, computers, cell phones, you know, everything that you use every day, appliances, especially car parts, is all moving by sea.
The Port of New Orleans is among the 20 busiest ports in the U.S. As a reference point, the Port of Los Angeles is number one. Unlike that port on the West Coast, the Port of New Orleans doesn't have massive cargo ships like the Dolly moving to places like its Napoleon Avenue container terminal. There's a few reasons for that. A big one, and this goes back to bridges, is the Crescent City Connection.
Due to the Crescent City Connection, we are limited in about 10,000 TEU ships here in New Orleans at Napoleon due to the air draft restriction there. That's the distance from the water, you know, its height of the vessel. And so,
Can you put a finer point on that, Matt? Because since it's an audio podcast, people can't see, but we have a great view of the Mississippi River flowing underneath the Crescent City Connection here, and there's barge traffic that moves underneath of this. But why are you limited in terms of the size of barges and ships that this terminal can handle?
So it's really just container ships, because container ships are actually higher in their build, and so we can do about 170 feet on the best day, 170 foot tall vessel here in New Orleans, and of course that fluctuates with the river stage. So certain times in a high river, that is much lower than that. And so one of the challenges that we've had as ships get bigger is you have vessels that are in rotation to other ports, because if you look at container services, it's much like an airline. That container ship will come into the Gulf of Mexico, it'll visit Houston, drop off, pick up some boxes, come to New Orleans, drop off, pick up boxes, and then go to Mobile and do the same thing. Unfortunately, what's happened in the last several years is ships are getting larger. When you have high river conditions and you have a reduced air draft at the Crescent City Connection, because of course Napoleon is above the Crescent City Connection on the river, then you have vessels that simply omit the Port of New Orleans altogether.
Because it just simply can't fit under the
bridge. Correct. They don't want to take the risk of possibly coming in and then not being able to get out, you know, until the river recedes. So that is the main impetus, and it has been for many years, of building the container terminal downriver, which we're now doing in Violet, Louisiana.
That container terminal Matt's talking about is the Louisiana International Terminal, or the LIT. The terminal figures to be one of the biggest, if not the biggest, project the port has ever undertaken. This is from a section of the port's website, placing the LIT in the context of the port's 123-year history. Here's how it reads. Quote, 2020, Port NOLA acquired land in St. Bernard Parish for the development of the Louisiana International Terminal, a 1.8 billion, 350-acre multimodal container terminal to serve the largest container vessels calling in the Gulf of Mexico, end quote. Other ports, like the Port of Houston, are moving ahead with their own expansions. This is a brief news clip from August of last year.
U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg toured the Houston Ship Channel today, cutting the ribbon at a Port of Houston terminal expansion project. The project aims to accommodate more containers and help speed up the movement of goods.
The tons of goods and products on these cargo ships are like money floating on water. And if you want to be a major player in the shipping game, then you better build the infrastructure to attract the jumbo-sized ships.
Well, I think the issue is more so if you don't build it, we will be left out. Louisiana will be left out altogether, because once they introduce those services with the 12, 15,000 TEU ships into the Gulf of Mexico, if Louisiana can't handle that, if the port of New Orleans can't handle that,
they'll just be bypassed
and you'll be left out of that. And then that business, that impact will go elsewhere, and we'll just be left out of that part of shipping.
But by having that terminal south of the Crescent City Connection, you believe LIT can handle that traffic then?
Yeah, I think that, and 100%. And I think that's evident by the market that's already come to us as partners in the terminal project itself. You know, we have Terminal Investment Limited, which is the investment arm of Mediterranean Shipping Company, which is the largest container carrier in the world, MSC, and them along with Ports America, which has been our long-term partner here and one of the largest terminal operators in North America. They've committed $800 million to the terminal. The federal government, through recent two grant awards, contributing $300 million. And so right there, you're at $1.1 billion from the outside coming in. And we have committed $500 million to the project itself. And so the state legislature has been fully supportive and helpful. You know, I think that shows the optimism and the confidence that they really have in the market of New Orleans.
From what I understand, at least just from some of the articles I've read, this is like the largest economic development project in state history then?
For public infrastructure. You look at port projects, the LNG market, which has blown up, you know, Venture Global down in Plaquemines and also in Lake Charles and others. You know, those are multi-billion-dollar investments, but they're all very private investments that are being made by those groups. But as far as a facility that at the end of the day is a public facility and owned and operated by the citizens of Louisiana, yes, it would be the largest public infrastructure project that, and that's taking out bridges and, you know, highway construction.
Sure.
But something that's actually producing economic development there. We had our LSU economists kind of look at this and say, what happens if you don't build it? What's the economic ramifications, the impact of the state on the red side? And, you know, you're talking about more than $200 million in existing state and local taxes that would disappear. Also, roughly 10,000 existing jobs that would no longer be supported. But on the contrary, if you build this, and you're successful in also attracting those distribution centers, which I think we're already seeing along the I-12 corridor. We've got a lot of interest in, like I said, in New Orleans East and in St. Bernard Parish to build these facilities. You're talking, you know, 18,000 new jobs throughout the region and the state, you know, that are going to be the beneficiary of this, and close to $1 billion in total new tax revenue that will be flowing. You know, more than anything, I think, you know, it keeps Louisiana in the game and keeps it competitive with what I call the SEC states. We're competing against Alabama, we're competing against South Carolina, we're competing against Georgia and Florida and Texas and in this industry. And, you know, I've often joked that, you know, if we were getting beat in football or baseball, you know, by those states, we'd call a special session to address it from the legislature.
It would be hell to be raised, for sure.
You know, if the scoreboard was reflecting that, then I think we would see a lot more emphasis and focus on it from a state level.
When you think of a port, you usually think of water. In keeping with the football theme here, Matt says a thriving port also needs a strong ground game. You heard him talking about distribution centers. Matt told me attracting more of them to the state is vital because if you're going to have a new cargo container facility like the LIT, then you have to have a destination for all that cargo and a means to move it. The Port of New Orleans is confident that by building the LIT, it'll bring in more distribution centers and other types of business.
You have to create that demand through distribution centers. For instance, Louisiana was a finalist for a large Walmart distribution center that eventually went to Alabama, and the Port of Mobile services that now, and that was kind of the trigger. Of course, when you have an importer such as that, that's in your backyard, it attracts others. So it's just like, you know, the intersection of a highway. Once the Waffle House gets there, then something else goes there, and there's a CVS. And so that's really where we're focused on, and what we've already seen a lot of interest in with the discussion and the ongoing planning of the Louisiana International Terminal is we've seen a lot of interest, and that's between New Orleans East, St. Bernard Parish, the North Shore, Baton Rouge, on over to Lafayette, really from a lot of different developers of distribution centers that see that Louisiana is wholly underserved as a distribution market. One example that's kind of embarrassing that one of our commercial folks came to me with was that we in Louisiana have more Dollar General stores per capita than anywhere else in the country. Yet we don't have a Dollar General store distribution center in Louisiana. It's all serviced by Texas and Mississippi and Alabama. So we're buying cheap things, but we're not getting the benefit of other people buying those cheap things.
Some perspective and patience is going to be necessary. If all goes according to plan, the LIT will come online in 2028. There's been some local opposition to it from some residents and politicians in St. Bernard who say they're worried about issues like the size of the new terminal and the increase in truck traffic. But overall, the project has plenty of backing, money, and momentum. That said, when it does get up and running, Matt says it will likely be years before the benefits can be reaped.
The container facility is not a build it and they will come philosophy unless you're in Shanghai or you're in LA or something like that. So it takes a team effort, and that's why we're looking at, you know, over a 20-year period of building that market here. You know, this wouldn't be a flip of the switch and you're suddenly doing 2 million TEUs overnight.
Ultimately, the Port of New Orleans and others like it have to make strategic decisions and investments when it comes to the ever-increasing size of cargo ships. In many regards, ports are trying to catch up and keep up with the growth of cargo ships. They're doing so by creating the infrastructure to accommodate them. In some cases, they're physically digging deep. Is the Port of New Orleans hamstrung because it doesn't have the infrastructure to handle that type of cargo container ship?
Today it is. Like I said, we are limited at a 10,000 TEU vessel at the Port of New Orleans, at Louisiana is today. And so we need to have that terminal downriver because the shippers are telling us that in 3-4 years, the workhorse vessel in the Gulf will be that 10,000 to 12,000 to potentially 15,000 TEU ship that's going to be calling on those ports. Port of Houston is in the process of widening and deepening its channel. Mobile is in the process of deepening its channel. We just recently completed the deepening of the Mississippi River, the first phase, which is about 190 miles of river, well through New Orleans and most of Port of South Louisiana to 50 feet. So we can handle it by water draft, and really that's a huge benefit. The deepening is a huge benefit to the bulk carriers that's carrying grain, that's carrying energy, that's carrying chemicals, because of course they can load deeper and get out. So that's already, Louisiana's already seeing great benefits from that. However, on the container side, now you need to build the infrastructure to be able to handle the larger ships that have the air draft restriction. And so when you build south of Crescent City Connection, you have zero air draft restriction to the Gulf of Mexico.
Because you don't have a bridge like Crescent City Connection.
No, and you know, you look at the Port of New York, New Jersey, they recently in the last few years completed the expansion of the Bayonne Bridge, to which they just basically raised it and spent $1.2 billion just raising the bridge so they could handle the increased shipping.
Getting back to where we started with the Key Bridge collapse, I think it's natural and almost unavoidable to have the could it happen here discussion. But that discussion can be a fairly short one. If you're talking about accidents, which so far is what the elision in Baltimore appears to be, then you can say yes, it could happen here, because accidents are unpredictable by their nature and definition, which is why they often get the attention they do. If you want to be more specific and ask, could something like that happen at the Crescent City Connection, then the short answer is yes, but with an asterisk. An elision could happen at the bridge, but it won't involve a cargo ship like the Dolly because of the clearance issues Matt told us about. What ports like the Port of New Orleans would like to see is more of these monster cargo ships. Of course, the sheer size of these ships can be viewed as a potential threat to safety. But if you're the Port of New Orleans, there's a real danger in letting that business pass on by. In New Orleans, I'm Tan Trung for WWL Radio.